From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. A recent U.S. Supreme Court decision offered a big victory for school choice across the country. You'll learn about the Espinoza case's potential impact for North Carolina. Count a North Carolina senator among those willing to back federal action on police reform. You'll hear him discuss the topic with the leader of a group called the Center for Policing Equity. COVID-19 has had a significant impact on farms and government agriculture policy. We'll highlight key pieces of that impact with help from an expert at the Heritage Foundation. And we'll discuss how a new HBO drama is sending a message about occupational licensing restrictions. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us, and she has the Carolina Journal headline.
As parents search for a plan to educate their kids this fall, a plan that works for them and not just for their local public school system, one state leader is reminding low- and middle-income parents that they have a scholarship opportunity if they want their child to attend a private school. Dr. Terry Stoops is vice president for research. He's also the director of education studies at the John Locke Foundation. He took notice at this news release because it's an issue that he has been writing about and following very closely. Terry, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Senate Leader Phil Berger, who's a Republican out of Rockingham County, issued this news release just a few days ago. It really raises the alarm about at-risk kids and the potential for virtual learning to really leave them out.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And thank goodness we have an opportunity scholarship program in the first place so that our low-income kids can have access to private schools. And that's needed now more than ever in an environment where a lot of the school districts in North Carolina and charter schools are migrating to full-time remote learning plans. The numbers keep changing on that, but around 30% of school districts, around 15% of charter schools have adopted full-time remote learning plans. And that encompasses around 40% of the students in the state, and I suspect that's going to increase even more. So the opportunities for kids to go to a school that has in-person learning is diminishing every day. And so to have something like the Opportunity Scholarship available to kids that would be in untenable positions when a full-time remote learning plan is absolutely essential.
Tell us a little bit more about the Opportunity Scholarship. Who qualifies and how does it work?
The Opportunity Scholarship Program is targeted toward low-income households. So we're looking at households. I believe that the very top threshold is around $65,000 for a family of four. And that's household income, not just individual income. And those students are only eligible for 90% of the $4,200 scholarship that's offered through the Opportunity Scholarship. So this is a minimal amount of money. It doesn't cover all the costs of a private school, but it's enough that thousands of families every year sign up for the Opportunity Scholarship so that they can have at least most of the tuition at a private school covered. And they're not attending the expensive private schools that a lot of people think of when they think of a private school, the Ravenscroft or Asheville School. They're attending mainly faith-based, small private schools that have tuition around $6,000 or $7,000 a year. So they do have skin in the game. And they are also accessing scholarships that are offered by the schools themselves. So,
and we know over the past several years by looking at the people who have applied for and received the Opportunity Scholarship that this has turned out to be a lifeline for some families who either find that the traditional public school and public classroom isn't working for their child, or families where you have an unusual situation. You might have a grandparent in the position of being the legal guardian and caring for a child and wanting to make sure that that child has the very best opportunity possible. So it really is a lifeline for all sorts of reasons. Yet, Terry, we know in our state that there are some elected officials, some lawmakers, who don't like this at all, and they're pushing to get rid of it.
Definitely. And there are plenty of lawmakers that don't like the Opportunity Scholarship, and they say that that money should only go to public schools. And, of course, our governor is the biggest opponent of the Opportunity Scholarship program. He has come out on many occasions saying that he wants to get rid of those vouchers, and he wants to phase out the Opportunity Scholarship program. In fact, he's proposed budgets that would do just that, that would allow no new students to come into the program. That's the kind of dislike that a lot of Democrats, especially of the more liberal wing, have toward the Opportunity Scholarship Program. Now, it's not universal by any means. There are Democratic support for the Opportunity Scholarship Program, recognizing that, first, one size fits all is a poor way to educate kids, but more than anything, that we're talking about low-income, mostly ethnic and racial minority children that would ordinarily not have access to a private school if not for the Opportunity Scholarship Program.
Terry, you used an interesting phrase, one size fits all, and we've talked a lot about that here on Carolina Journal Radio, and you, as the education expert, have written so much about the need to give parents options to empower them to be able to choose whatever environment works best for their family, for their child. As we head towards the fall school year, you mentioned that a number of local school districts are now choosing to go online only, at least in the beginning. And you've written a really compelling piece available at CarolinaJournal.com that talks about the kids who will be left behind with this one-size-fits-all online environment. And one of the categories that you mention is a category that we have a lot of in our state and in our country, and that is single parents trying to take care of kids.
That's right. When you look in North Carolina at households and you look at how many are led by a single mother or single father, it's around 30% of households with children are led by a single father or a single mother. And in fact, if you even look deeper at the statistics, the percentage of households that are led by a single father is increasing significantly, and I believe it's the highest that it's ever been. So consider the plight of these parents that are now faced with the prospect of a district or a charter school going to full-time remote learning. How does that parent navigate that environment if they have to go to work and they're looking at having to either allow their child to be supervised by someone else or find some alternative arrangement for them? Unfortunately, there aren't a whole lot of opportunities to find alternative arrangements. We're only about 3 weeks before the beginning of the school year, so being able to access a charter school would be difficult at this point. That parent could choose to homeschool, but that's kind of difficult if they're the sole breadwinner of the family. So things like the Opportunity Scholarship and private schools, and really the goodwill and philanthropy of those organizations, civic organizations, churches, and others that are trying to fill the void makes it extremely difficult on that segment, among many other segments of the population, to be able to navigate this new educational environment.
Terry, what about homeless kids? I mean, they will be completely left out of this.
And no one's talking about homeless kids. And in the piece, I give a shout out to Brenda Berg of because Brenda has been really at the forefront of talking about what's going to happen with homeless students if they are in a school district that has decided to go with a full-time remote learning plan. She's the one that's really bringing that up, and no one else is really talking about it. And so state education leaders really need to start talking about these populations, the ones that are really at a disadvantage here of the decision of school boards to go to a full-time remote plan.
It's a really compelling piece. I would encourage everyone to read it at carolinajournal.com. The kids that are and will be left behind by a plan to go to online learning only. It's written by our guest, Dr. Terry Stoops, who's Vice President for Research and the Director of Education Studies at the John Locke Foundation. Terry, thank you very much for the piece. It's an amazing piece, and thanks for joining us to talk about it.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly, but our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The U.S. Supreme Court recently delivered a victory to school choice supporters across the country. Joining us now to assess the good news is Mike Long. He is president of Parents for Educational Freedom in North Carolina. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Mitch. Nice to be with you again.
We are talking about a ruling in a case called Espinoza versus Montana Department of Revenue. You recently wrote a column about this, and the headline was, Supreme Court Affirms School Choice, Tar Heel State Celebrates. Why is the Tar Heel State celebrating?
Well, we are celebrating because we have such a fantastic program called the Opportunity Scholarship in North Carolina that provides scholarship funding for working class, low income families that are stuck in the zip coded school that is not meeting their needs. And it provides them opportunity to go to the school of their choice, particularly a private school. And even if it's a private religious school, the Supreme Court has upheld that these public funds can be used for those types of programs. So that's a great victory when we have approximately 12,000 students here in North Carolina, families in North Carolina, that are benefiting from the current Opportunity Scholarship here.
This is a case that came out of Montana, and some of the particulars are not ones that would particularly play out here in North Carolina. Yet you're looking at this ruling as something that really does have positive benefits even in our state.
It does, because in 2015, our Opportunity Scholarship Program was challenged in the North Carolina Supreme Court because of the religious implications, primarily using tax dollars to fund scholarships for parents to go to private schools or religious schools. That ruling was upheld in our favor in 2015. So now that the Supreme Court has essentially done the same thing in the Montana case, that is from the top of top, so to speak, which is why we are really celebrating that outcome.
You, in your column, called this the most important and far-reaching school choice decision by the Supreme Court in decades. It had to be good news as a person who supports school choice to see that the highest court in the land does have this support for choice.
It's saying that the state cannot discriminate against parents who choose a private school or even a Christian school or Islamic school or Jewish school. You cannot discriminate against parents' choice to go to schools like that. Besides, they're taxpayers as well, and these are tax dollars, but this is not supporting a particular religion. It's freedom of religion, not freedom from religion. And so this court upheld, the Supreme Court upheld that, and that's why we are celebrating.
You mentioned in the column some of the specifics about the plaintiff in this case, Kendra Espinoza, a single mother in Montana working three jobs, and she'd used Montana's scholarship to send her daughters to a faith-based private school of her own choice. I'm guessing as you learned about this plaintiff, you were thinking of some of the people in North Carolina who are in very similar circumstances using opportunity scholarships.
That's correct. And that's what's so incredible about the opportunity scholarship program. It is liberating families in our state where they are stuck in the zip-coded school that the state requires them to attend, and they are not getting the success from it for their children. Parents know best what their children needs in their education. And so the fact that they can now have economic opportunity to make the choice that best fits the needs of their children educationally is a tremendous benefit. That's why we say it's liberating families. It's getting them out of a situation where their kids can't grow or their family cannot grow because they do not have equal access to great educational opportunities.
That is the voice of Mike Long. He is president of Parents for Educational Freedom in North Carolina. And one of the interesting aspects of this is as the Supreme Court is making this ruling, we know that there are some people in North Carolina, including people in positions of high government power, who are not fans of the Opportunity Scholarship Program. How helpful is it to have a ruling like this when our program faces some high-profile opposition?
Well, it means they will not be able to challenge this again in the Supreme Court. It's already been decided. And so the issues of expanding the program or not expanding the program has to be done in the legislature. Right now, our legislature is very supportive of this program, even has a 10-year window out of it growing. Unfortunately, our current governor is very much against the program, actually saying that he believes that the Opportunity Scholarship is an expense that needs to stop. And so Parents for Educational Freedom in North Carolina will continue to fight for families across our state to indeed have the educational freedom to choose the school of their choice that best fits the needs of their children, as opposed to the state saying, we know better for everyone, or we want a one-size-fits-all system that is not meeting the needs of all the families in North Carolina, especially when you have 20% of our families right now choosing alternative styles of education rather than just the public school system. That's pretty incredible. That's incredible growth, and we hope that it will continue to grow to best fit the needs of families in North Carolina.
As much as this Supreme Court ruling is a reason for celebration in North Carolina and across the country, you alluded to this, but you also say in the column, this is not a time to just sit back and say, okay, it's over, we've won. There's still a lot of work to do.
Absolutely. There was a bill introduced in the legislature just recently where 40 Democrats, actually not one Republican, signed on to it, where there was language in the bill to eliminate the Opportunity Scholarship Program in North Carolina. So they are definitely trying to carry out the orders of the governor to accomplish this goal. And Parents for Educational Freedom will always be there to fight this on behalf of families and students and children throughout the state.
We've talked about this and named it the Opportunity Scholarship. But for those who are unfamiliar, remind us how this works and how parents can take advantage of it.
Probably one of the best ways to do that is to, first of all, go to our website, which is pefnc.org. What we do is we try to find families that will qualify for this. We help walk them through the application process with the state. We help get them funded. And then we help them find the school that best meets the needs of their children. So Parents for Educational Freedom is the leader in that throughout the state, and we're here to help any family who feels like they're stuck or just not getting the kind of education that they need in their zip-coded public school to contact us, and we will help them get a scholarship that can get them to the school that will best meet those needs.
If they qualify and if they could find a school that helps, believe you get up to $4,200 a
That's
year.
That's right. $4,200 is the maximum amount. We understand that tuitions can be more than that, but we do believe that parents should also have a little bit of investment in that education as well. But usually a lot of these private schools will offer financial aid to help meet those needs and so forth. So there are all kinds of great opportunities thanks to the Opportunity Scholarship Program. program where we can help parents find those schools that will best meet those needs, not only for their children's education, but also meet those needs financially.
Going back to the column and the way that you wrap it up, you called the Espinoza decision an enormous loss for the education elite, decision-making class, teachers' unions, and supporters of the educational status quo, but enormous victory for students and families, particularly those of less means. Why do you think that this outcome from the Supreme Court is so important moving forward?
Because the educational system, as we know it, was developed back during the Industrial Revolution. It is so outdated. And the thought that one size fits all in today's technological world is just ridiculous.
That is the voice of Mike Long. He is president of Parents for Educational Freedom in North Carolina. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Count North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis among those who want to see more federal action on police reform. He discussed the topic in a recent hearing on Capitol Hill.
I've been heartened by a lot of the comments here because it really sounds like we all understand there's a problem. We need to act on it. Then every once in a while, I'll hear a drift on either my side or you all's side that makes me concerned that we're going to get close and then we're going to back off into our corners at the expense of making real progress. And I think there's a chance to make real progress.
Tillis says better law enforcement training should help.
They're good people, the vast majority of them. They just need training and situational awareness where they're in these untenable positions that humans make bad mistakes. Not in the case of Floyd. That was a bad human making a bad mistake, and I hope he spends a lot of time in prison.
Tillis shared a personal story.
I remember vividly, I lived in a neighborhood in Nashville, Tennessee. Family fell on hard times, had to sell the house, moved into a trailer park about a mile and a half down the road. I can tell you, the police were cruising through that trailer park a hell of a lot more than that house I lived in a mile and a half down the road, and they looked at you differently. So there is a socioeconomic and racial component to this that we just have to recognize and work on it.
Tillis had questions for Philip Atiba-Goff of the Center for Policing Equity.
I think that data ultimately is going to help us do a better job of coming up with good decisions that we can come together on. Do we have data right now that would suggest that there's a correlation between events that are occurring in a community and a bad outcome like we saw in Minnesota?
I think the question is, can we figure out what's going to be the next Ferguson? Where's going to be the next Minneapolis? And are we currently collecting those data? And do we have the techniques to do it? And I'd say that, first of all, no, we're not collecting the data, because what we are collecting, even in major cities, the 18,000 police departments we've got, let's remember, 75% of them are 25 officers or fewer. There's 1,000 departments that are just one guy.
It's not a matter of having to cast a wider net for data. It's a matter of having the ability to aggregate data that probably exists in one form or another so that we can use it even in a predictive way over time.
That's right. Also, we need the actual people who can do the analysis, because data don't speak to us unless we've got someone who can do a responsible analysis. But part of the question you're asking is about data from communities, because we can't get it just from police behavioral data. We need to know how the community is feeling about their law enforcement, because the same sort of on paper shooting that happens in a community that trusts their law enforcement, feels good and feels protected, has a very different outcome, right, than a shooting that happens where folks don't trust law enforcement. So we need more and different, and we also need the capacity to do that analysis.
That's the president of the Center for Policing Equity answering questions from North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis during a recent hearing on Capitol Hill. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. As the COVID-19 pandemic disrupts food supply in the United States, a national expert is offering North Carolina some helpful analysis. Darren Baxt focuses on agriculture issues for the Heritage Foundation. He took part in a recent online forum sponsored by the John Locke Foundation. Baxt started by identifying two separate food supply issues.
54 cents of every dollar spent on food was spent outside the house. And what we've seen is a drastic change in the nature of the demand for food and where the demand is coming from. And that kind of applies across the food supply. And that has led to dairy producers dumping milk, or produce producers letting fruit rot. And it's because there's no destinations for their product anymore because of this changing nature of the demand. So the market, it needs to adapt, and it is. The food supply chain will adapt to kind of shift down to the more of a retail-focused market. Now, the meat supply and poultry issues unique is it's connected primarily to the illnesses that exist in the meat processing plants. And what we are seeing is capacity lower than it's been, And some plants have closed across the country. I'm glad to hear that North Carolina hasn't been as hurt, has been hurt like other states have been. But I think most consumers and the people watching this are going to probably see less meat in the grocery store. It's going to be higher prices. You know, you'll still see meat, but you may not have some of the choices that you'd want. So instead of chicken breast, you might see chicken thighs. And what President Trump did was he issued an executive order addressing the meat processing plant challenges that exist. Some of the media reports make it sound as if the president mandated that these plants remain open. That's not what he did. He did give the authority to the Secretary of Agriculture to address these issues. Part of it could be to mandate the plants be open, but that's highly unlikely, and that's not what they're trying to do. And it's really critical to understand that in that executive order, all the actions need to be consistent with the guidance of the federal government in terms of health. So the health and safety of workers is critical. And if we're going to address the meat supply disruptions that exist, we have to address the health and safety of these workers.
Baxt says the pandemic has raised people's awareness about food.
I think we're starting to realize how complicated the food supply chain is right now and how many people are involved and how many people are on the front lines. It's not simply the farmers and the ranchers or at the other end, the grocery stores and the restaurants. There's so many different steps along the way, including people I think that don't get enough credit are the truck drivers who are out there making sure that the food actually and other products get to these locations. We got to make sure that the regulations that kind of hinder their ability to get those products sufficiently to us, the consumers, don't overburden them, and they can actually do their job. So we should also kind of bear in mind the logistics and the transportation steps and many other steps along the way.
That's Darren Baxt, agricultural policy expert for the Heritage Foundation. How can we ensure that agricultural industry workers feel safe on the job?
I think it certainly helps to follow the CDC and OSHA guidance. That would help. But there are inherent challenges that exist in these plants because if you follow the social distancing guidelines, that would lower processing speeds because then you just wouldn't have as many people at the facilities. Now, that might be something you just simply have to do. That might mean that the workers will feel safer. And if they have the necessary protective equipment, they'll feel safer. But there might be, for a decent amount of time, some slower processing speeds as a result of those steps. But I think that's certainly worth it if that's what's necessary to get them working and feeling confident to go to the plants and get, yes, the meat that a lot of us expect.
Baxt referenced discussions on Capitol Hill that could affect the food supply.
There is some federal legislation called the Prime Act that would. So under current law, it is illegal for farmers and ranchers to bring their animals to custom slaughterhouses to have the animals slaughtered and then use that meat and sold commercially. It's quite sweeping for Congress to believe that they should regulate the intrastate market for meat, but that's exactly how the system works. So the Prime Act would actually allow more flexibility and make it possible for farmers or ranchers, and this would probably cover smaller, I mean, it would impact smaller producers more, to actually go to these custom slaughterhouses, have the meat and the animals slaughtered and have the meat sold commercially, which they can't do now. And that's useful for them. That might help to create a different market. I don't know that that would have a huge impact in the short term simply because there's not a lot of capacity at these facilities. But I will say that the fact that these regulations that existed in the first place certainly has hindered competition. And maybe if this Prime Act became law or something similar became law, maybe we'll see some changing dynamics within the marketplace.
Baxt talked about the importance of short-term versus long-term considerations when changing public policies related to the food supply.
I think we just need to bear in mind that we are in a unique situation right now and that any policies we develop now and in the future, you know, should, I mean, we're focused now on this particular pandemic and making sure things get more efficient. And then post-pandemic, when we develop policy, we want to make sure that we're not developing policy just making sure that we address pandemics, but we actually develop policy recognizing that pandemics are not the typical way of things. Now, on the regulatory side, on the farm, we talk about the farmers, There's a lot of environmental regulations like the Waters of the United States rule, permitting requirements for farmers that are questionable in terms of how burdensome they can be. The permitting requirements can be vague and confusing. So farmers, first of all, just getting the permits can be very costly. So that might discourage them from engaging even in ordinary activities, farming activities. And quite honestly, the laws can be so vague and confusing that might discourage farmers from engaging in the activities at all whatsoever, because these are civil and criminal penalties associated with some of these environmental laws. But kind of moving up the food chain, and some of the things that we're seeing, again, with truckers, we're seeing some waivers of hours of service regulations. I think some of those waivers should be better clarified, and some of those restrictions should be lifted. And then keeping going down as we go down to the retail side, we need to look at local laws that might make it more difficult for companies to deliver products directly to people. So delivery services, what kind of restrictions might apply to individuals. And one thing that's going on now is some restaurants are actually selling grocery store items. And one of the reasons why they're kind of able to do that is because in the past, the FDA would have labeling laws that would make it very difficult for them to sell the grocery store items from the restaurants because it wouldn't meet the nutritional labeling requirements. The FDA has given some flexibility on that. So that's why you've seen some restaurants, and I know that at least in the past, Subway and I think Panera Bread may have been selling some grocery store items as relates to food. So looking at labeling requirements is another way. So it is an interesting question to get for more efficiency. We can see how these waivers and these regulatory obstacles do create problems. If we get out of the way, we can make things work better. And then maybe after this, kind of get through this pandemic, we should see and evaluate whether or not these changes would make sense even after the pandemic.
That's Darren Baxt, Senior Research Fellow in Agricultural Policy for the Heritage Foundation. He took part in a recent online forum sponsored by the John Locke Foundation. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio and another edition of Locker Room Talk. I'm Donna Martinez, joined by my co-host Mitch Kopai. So who knew that a much-heralded HBO reboot of the Perry Mason detective series would not just be entertaining, as Mitch found out, but it could also offer a lesson in public policy. So, Mitch, tell us about this, because I'm fascinated. You wrote about this at CarolinaJournal.com. I love Perry Mason.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about this was I really did at 10 o'clock on a Sunday evening, as soon as the show was over, thought, you know, this actually has a good lesson about the dangers of occupational licensing.
Oh, my gosh.
So people who are familiar with Perry Mason, either through the Earl Stanley Gardner novels or more likely because of the long-running TV show with Raymond Burr,
right,
they know Perry Mason was this hotshot defense attorney. He goes into court week after week, and he's always defending the innocent, and he finds out who the guilty person is, usually on the stand,
right,
getting the person to admit it.
The Perry Mason moment.
Exactly. So now HBO has done a new series about Perry Mason. But at the start of the series, it wasn't the Perry Mason we know. This instead is a World War I vet who's struggling in Depression-era Los Angeles, early 1930s. He is ill-tempered, foul-mouthed, heavy drinking, seems to have a lot of problems, and he's not working as a lawyer. He's actually working as somewhat of a private detective, doing some investigative chores for another attorney.
This is so much different, the profile of than the Perry Mason we're used to.
Very different. And as the show goes on, you realize it's what and they call in the superhero world an origin story, because you learn about how he ended up becoming the attorney, Perry Mason. And so without giving too much away of the plot, because there might be some people who haven't watched it who would like to watch it.
Like me.
That's right. At some critical point in the story, the attorney who he had been working with dies. And the client is the chief suspect in the big case of the season. And so it turns out that this client is probably going to have to go with a court-appointed attorney who's in cahoots with the DA, except that the assistant of the attorney who just died comes up with this scheme that, hey, let's say Perry Mason, who's been working as this investigator, that you've been working in an apprenticeship with the attorney. And if you could somehow pass the bar exam between now and when the trial takes place, you can be the attorney.
No law school involved.
No law school involved. And I thought at the time, well, this is kind of far-fetched anyway. But in today's world, it would be impossible.
Yeah.
Because you wouldn't even be able to take the bar unless you'd had the credential of the 3-year law school experience and the law degree. I mean, people who want to be lawyers, they can't even just take like a year or so of law school and then get the rest through experience. You got to go all 3 years, get the law degree. And I thought, well, this is an interesting story. And there are a couple of other interesting pieces of this, too. One is the fact that the person who came up with this plan is Della Street. And if you're a fan of Perry Mason, you remember Della Street was Perry's secretary, assistant. In this version of it, Della is and the old Della was fine. She was a very important part of the piece, a part of the story. But this Della really ran the business and ran the office for that older attorney who died. So she knew the ins and outs, and you know that she's going to be helping Perry Mason as things go along. And I wrote in this column about this that, you know, having one talented, experienced Della is going to be worth more to Perry Mason than some third year law school class on a topic that he's never going to use again. The other interesting piece was, you know, for people who remember the Perry Mason show, the attorney he locks horns with case in and case out is the DA Hamilton Berger.
Oh, yeah.
Well, in the show, Hamilton Berger is this up and coming deputy district attorney who helps Perry Mason cram for the bar exam.
Oh, my gosh.
And he also, when he's meeting him, he tells him that he's this, you know, Ivy League law school guy. And so I thought, well, you know, if this show continues beyond just this initial origin story and Perry Mason beats Hamilton Berger in the courtroom, just as he did in the old show, it's going to show that someone with some talent and experience and knowledge can lock horns with the person who has all the diplomas. So it really all feeds into this idea that, you know, you don't necessarily need to have this credential if you've got other things working on your advantage. And that's something that we definitely need to talk about at this time of economic uncertainty.
Absolutely, because a number of our researchers, along with you, writing here for the John Locke Foundation, have been trying to make the case that we should be getting out of people's way, make it as easy as possible for qualified people who know what they're doing, who have knowledge and skills, to be able to get a job and earn a living. The last thing you want to do, particularly in difficult times like we're experiencing now, is to put up additional barriers that you really don't need. That's why I thought it was so cool when I read your column that you saw that in this episode of Perry Mason, because, in fact, a friend of ours, George Leaf, has been writing about this particular legal issue with credentialing and law school, et cetera, for a number of years. And it really brings us to this point of wondering, why do, in North Carolina and other states, why do we have so many fences that people have to jump, whether you want to be a barber, takes incredible amounts of time and school and money, et cetera, or whether you want to be an attorney 3 years and then pass the bar. Shouldn't it just be if you can illustrate that you're going to do the job, and if you don't do the job, someone's not going to hire you again?
Yeah, that should be the case. And what we see in many of these cases, you referenced the barbers, and also in the legal profession, it tends to be the entrenched interests get involved and convince people within the government, either within the executive branch or within the legislature, that, hey, you know, things will be better off for the customer if we set these government mandates. And so, you know, the law schools obviously want people to have to go to law school to become a lawyer, and the legal profession, it makes it easier if you're already a lawyer to put up barriers to keep other people from getting in. And so that's why we tend to see that sort of thing happen. Barbers as well, case after case in North Carolina. And right now, especially when we have the issues of people needing to find new jobs, you don't want those barriers.
Yeah. And it's built in customers in terms of the law school. You said, of course they want it. Well, certainly I'm sure there's dedicated law professors who want to instill, you know, the new fresh minds who are going into the profession with all of their experience and knowledge. Of course. But at the same time, when you always know there is a fresh crop of students who are required to come into your business of operating a law school, I mean, it means that they really don't have a choice of any other avenues, because what if someone wanted to be an apprentice to a Perry Mason or a well-known attorney? And what if that turned out to not only be as valuable as a traditional 3 years of law school, but what if it was really even more important? Can you imagine if you were actually an apprentice in a courtroom for a major trial? You know, it just brings up, I think, common sense questions about how we're going about this.
Yeah, and I think one of the best lines, if I may say so, in that column was the real-life Perry Masons can't become Perry Masons these days because of all those barriers. And you think about someone out there who is a great potential legal mind. Some of them can go through the hoops. Others say, you know, I can't do 7 years of formal higher ed that I'm going to have to pay for.
Yeah, the pay part is big, too.
Exactly. I've got to do something else. And so we're lost of their talents when it comes to becoming legal minds, barbers, or whatever else they might do where the government stands in the way.
I'll tell you what, it's a really interesting column written by my friend Mitch Kokai. You can find it at carolinajournal.com, all about the Perry Mason reboot. Mitch, thanks very much.
Thank you, Donna.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. I'm Donna Martinez on behalf of Mitch Kokai. Hope you'll come back again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.